Welcome, everybody. This is the sixth and final office hour session for the Mises Academy class, Political Philosophy, PP 800, Anarcho-Capitalism. Today is September 8th, 2012. Okay, great. We've got some questions already piling up, as always. For those of you who are tuned in, just go ahead and type your questions out, because then that'll regulate how fast I answer the ones that I'm working on. Before I jump into the pending questions, though, let me just mention, so this last week we talked about Etienne de Labouette and his discourse on voluntary servitude and so forth, and then the implications that had, because that's the two-pronged thing, that it's in him diagnosing why is it that a few people can basically rule over everybody else. His diagnosis then leads to the prescription in terms of what if you don't like the way things are going, how would you change it? And his point was, since this handful of people that have such power over the rest of society, it's not that they're superhumans, it's that the rest of society, in a certain sense, but an important one, voluntarily gives them this authority, then if you don't like what they're doing with it, if you think that the rulers are unjust, you don't need to kill them, you don't need to fight anybody, you just need to withdraw that which they never could get from you without you giving it to them in the first place. So I bring that up again because I was just listening to the Lou Rockwell show, and it was episode 305, so I'm putting the URL in the chat box there. So if you go to the Lou Rockwell show at lourockwell.com, if you're not familiar with it, along the top banner there, there's, I think it's called podcast. You click that, and then you can see, you know, he has a podcast. And episode 305 was when he was on Robert Wenzel's podcast, I think he calls it, the Robert Wenzel show. And they were talking about Murray Rothbard primarily, but one of the things that came up was Rothbard's sort of resurrecting De Labouette for a modern audience. And Lou Rockwell then seconded the conclusion that I was drawing from it as well, saying, you know, we can put to one side whether under libertarian theory or whatever your religious views are or whatever, whether you're morally justified in taking up arms against what you consider to be an unjust government. The point is, if De Labouette is right, that's really not necessary. And Rockwell says, I'm paraphrasing, but he had a pretty eloquent section there in the interview saying things like, look, violence and using guns and bullets, that's the kind of stuff the government does. That's how political officials get their way, is they use violence or they threaten people. And so it's sort of fitting that the way you would combat that is not using their own tactics against them, but just, you know, using completely peaceful, voluntary means, educating people, and just once you show people the nature of the state, the way somebody like Rothbard saw it, then, you know, that person's on your side if you've convinced them. Okay, let me hop into your questions now. So anyway, just to conclude that, I would encourage you to listen to that podcast. So Donald Koss asks me, in Roderick Long's paper, Libertarian Anarchism, Responses to 10 Objections, which was part of the material for week 4, part of his response in question 1 is, quote, you find people in the 17th and 18th centuries saying, look, all the civilized countries are monarchies, democracy would never work, end quote. And so now this is Donald talking. I find this quite interesting. It is reminiscent of what I hear today about anarchy. So then Donald's question to me, I guess, is, can you provide references that Long was alluding to, that is, writings of those centuries discussing how democracy could not work? Off the top of my head, I can't. I mean, it's not that I know. Long is certainly not making that up. I mean, I have seen discussions like that. What you might do is look at Thomas Paine's book, The Rights of Man. And then in there, what he does in that book is sort of, I think it was like a response to Edmund Burke. But anyway, what Thomas Paine is doing in that book is sort of, it's ironic, he's kind of justifying the French Revolution, obviously not them killing people and stuff, but the nature of standing up to an unjust system. So I'm not positive. I haven't looked at The Rights of Man since undergrad, but Paine at that time was basically arguing against the true conservatives, meaning like the people who were defending the old order against these newfangled ideas of representative government and, you know, people having inborn natural rights, and that if the government doesn't respect those rights, then it's illegitimate and needs to go, that kind of thing. And so, and Paine was attacking monarchy, or at least hereditary monarchy. So, if you happen to have that book handy, then I imagine if you flip through that, you might see him quoting people and then knocking them down. So, to be clear, Thomas Paine isn't saying what Roderick Long is talking about, but Thomas Paine would be arguing against those kind of people, and it wouldn't surprise me if he mentioned a few of them by name or even quoted from them. Other than that, I mean, you could email Roderick also. Here, and I'll send him an email right now. So you don't need to email. I'll email him right now. Well, this is fresh in my mind. So other people, if you got questions, go ahead and type them out while I'm doing this, because I don't want to forget. Roderick Long. So if he answers me, I will let you guys know what he says. Okay, and George Smith says The Rights of Man is available at Mises.org. So you don't even have to buy it or anything. Okay, George Smith asks me, can I ask a question about interest rates? Yes, you can. So anybody who's tuned in, everything's fair game. Obviously, if you have a question about anarcho-capitalism or the material that we're doing, that's preferable, just because more people might be interested in that, but this is a free-for-all, so whatever you want to ask me is fine. So George says, my understanding, a high interest rate induces people to save, discourages firms from borrowing. As savings increase, the interest rate drops, encouraging borrowing, discouraging savings. At the low interest rate, people will be spending more, going to restaurants more often, taking cruises perhaps, because the incentive to save has been reduced. Also, at the low interest rate, firms will be expanding for the future. This scenario would have people spending more and firms expanding at the same time. It sounds like pure Keynesianism. Something's wrong. Can you help? Okay. You just need to be careful about the difference between what we stress in principles classes, or if you took my academy class on, what do we call it? Maybe we did call it Principles of Economics or something like that. Anyway, where I use Lessons for the Young Economist as a textbook, if you've ever seen me teach a class going through that, this distinction is between, let me type this out too, just so you can see, it's between movement of supply or demand versus movement along the supply or demand curve. Okay, so it's a difference between the, if you're thinking of a supply and demand curve, it's a difference between the curve itself moving versus the price changing, and then you move along the stable curve. So that's kind of why you're getting tripped up here. So if you've got an original, I don't have the pen. Let me see here if I can, I don't know if I can do it. Do a drawing, and if I had the, they changed the way this thing works. I don't know if I'm gonna be able to do this on the fly. I was gonna try to draw you a little diagram on the side here, but I'm at my house. I don't have the pen thing. So if you have an original equilibrium, And then all of a sudden you say, hey, suppose people, their preferences change and they become more future-oriented. Right, so we're talking about the household now, the consumer, you know, the individuals, and they decide, the husband and wife, are they have a baby, let's say, and they realize, whoa, now that we got a kid, we need to save more because college is going to be expensive or whatever. And so they say, okay, what are we going to do? Well, we want to start putting away an extra $500 a month. How are we going to afford that? Well, we can stop going out to dinner so much. We can buy not as expensive clothes or whatever it is, and they cut back on their budget. So, and then there's households all over the community doing the same thing. So if that's the story, the way that plays out then is the supply curve of savings shifts to the right, or loanable funds. The supply curve of loanable funds shifts to the right, and the firms, businesses, their preferences didn't change. It's not like there's some new technology and now they can produce more capital goods with the same amount of inputs or something, or that they expect to, you know, so they're the same. And so what we want to have happen is we want firms to switch away from producing present goods, and we want them to get ready to produce more goods in the future. And so how do they get this information? Because how do they know the husband and wife just had a talk? Well, because the supply curve of loanable funds shifts to the right, that pushes down the interest rate. And now at the lower interest rate, the firms can borrow more cheaply. So they run the numbers and say, oh, this investment project that before was unprofitable at 8%, now it's profitable because interest rates are only 4%. And so they go ahead and borrow the money and invest in that. And so what's going on there is, don't get mixed up. You don't think, oh, wait a minute, interest rates just fell, so now the households are going to consume more. Because, no, in that particular story, the reason the interest rate fell was they decided to start saving more. Their preferences changed. The supply curve of loanable funds itself shifted to the right. So even at a lower interest rate, they're actually saving a higher fraction of their income than they were before. All right, So that's what's happening. I don't know if that made sense. So I just gave you one possible scenario where the households save more, that pushes down the equilibrium interest rate, and then the firms end up borrowing more and investing more because of the lower interest rate. But that's the chain of causality. So the supply curve of loanable funds shifted, the demand curve stayed the same. Since the supply curve shifted, the equilibrium interest rate dropped. Then the drop in the interest rate moving along the stable demand curve led firms to borrow more, but households are saving more. Because you're right, you can't. If firms are going to borrow more, then the households have to be saving more. You can't have that mismatch, or at least it would be unsustainable if you did have such a mismatch. Okay, George follows up and he says, consumers don't react to a change in interest rate in your scenario. It's the consumers are causing the change in the interest rate. In that scenario I just gave you. So I don't know if this is what's messing you up. I mean, not every single household does the exact same thing. So in the real world, if a bunch of families all of a sudden have a kid and decide to start saving more, but then there are other couples out there who their preferences haven't changed, yes, those other couples will save less, other things equal, now that interest rates are lower. Or if they weren't saving, if they were borrowing before, they might even borrow more now because interest rates are lower. So that would, in a sense, absorb some of the extra saving from the households that are now having kids, and they realize, oh, we better save more for the future. So businesses wouldn't invest as much as they otherwise would. But that makes sense. I mean, that's the interest rate wouldn't fall as much, given that there are these other households now who are going to borrow more, given the increased saving of some of their other households. So I don't know if I'm answering your question. Let me, a different way, I'm trying to think. I don't want to go through it, the other aspect of it, because Austrians are real particular about how they talk about the interaction of capital productivity on interest rates and stuff, so I don't want to spell out the other aspect of it. But it's like, switch it, get away from interest rates for a minute, and that might be what's confusing you. You just think in terms of apples. All right, so there's a supply and demand curve for apples, and you could say, oh, the supply curve's upward sloping, so the higher the price of apples, the more apples producers want to bring to market. And the higher the price of apples, the fewer apples consumers want to buy, because apples are more expensive now, so people don't buy as many apples, they buy something else. But it would still be the case, and so what happens now if there's a really good harvest, if the conditions are right, and there's a really good harvest, how do you explain that with the regular supply and demand curves? You'd say, well, the supply curve for apples shifted to the right, and then that pushed down the equilibrium price, and now the consumers go to the store and see apples are really cheap, so they buy a bunch more. So that's the way the market mechanism translates this abundance of the apple crop. It gives the right signal, so consumers end up putting more apples in their shopping carts, which is, you know, well, that has to happen, because otherwise the apples would rot. So it's got to be the case if there's a bunch of apples, they all end up in the consumer's shopping cart. So how does that happen? Well, the price goes down. So that seems weird. It seems like, wait a minute, you're telling me the producers are going to sell more apples even though the price is lower? That doesn't make any sense. I thought producers would sell fewer apples if the price is lower. Don't producers want, you know, aren't supply curves upward sloping? Right, but that's a given supply curve. And in that story, we're saying because of the rainfall or just the extra sunshine or whatever, the farmers used a new fertilizer or something, the apple crop was unusually large. And so the way you model that is you show the supply curve itself shifting to the right. So the supply curve is still upward sloping, but the whole curve moved to the right because of this changed condition. So that made sense, and then it's the same type of thing with the supply and demand for loanable funds. And this isn't even Austrian, this is just standard mainstream economics. Okay, Malcolm Arnold I'll read these questions off, Malcolm, but you're asking me stuff that I don't think I know much of this off the top of my head. Certainly not the beginning ones, but I'll read them. So Malcolm says, can you compare how absolute the colonial charters were? No, I can't do that off the top of my head. I mean, I'm not a historian. If you want to email Tom Woods, you know, he might know, but I don't know that off the top of my head. And if I were to try, I'd be Googling it. I mean, that's what I would do. They says, do we know anything about how Icelandic government seats were a marketable commodity? What were the terms and how were they marketed? Again, the only thing I would know is the stuff that David Friedman has written. So I'm not telling you anything you don't already know. The next one, the Vergeld in ancient Iceland for murder was the equivalent of about 12 and a half years of wages, according to David Friedman. So let me make sure, in case people didn't read it, so they know what you're talking about. So the Vergeld, you could translate it like as a man price. So that was the deal in ancient Iceland, and why Friedman described their system as like something that a mad economist would design just to test the limits of his theories. Is there the if you kill somebody in cold blood, it was primarily a fine was imposed on you, right? So you had to pay the heirs or whoever the proper recipient was a certain amount of money as the price for taking another man's life, as opposed to it was like an offense against the realm, and then they had to grab you and put you in a cage, which is how the modern society tends to deal with that. right? So if you murder somebody, that may not have come up. That's something that's kind of important when you're thinking about the evolution of law, that one of the transformations to get to where we are now in the understanding of law is this distinction between what we now call criminal and civil law. And it's at some point it went, so you would think if I go and kill some guy, the primary victim, I mean, first of all, the primary victim is the guy, but now that he's dead, if we say, well, who's mad at me? Like, to whom do I owe retribution? You would think it would be his family, or like maybe his employer or something, you know, the people who are directly associated with the guy. But that's not how our society really works. The agency that I have to fear the most if I go kill somebody is the government, and they're going to come, and what's the DA going to say? He's going to say, it's this. If I do it, you know, I get in a bar fight and kill somebody, the district attorney is going to say it's the state of Tennessee versus Robert Murphy in the matter of blah, blah, blah. Right? So it's like I've committed an offense against the governor because I took, you know, I committed a homicide within the boundaries of the state of Tennessee. And so that's a really weird statist, literally, conception. And that's, first of all, because it's making it sound like we're all just on the land owned by the governor. And then also, how the heck does that help the family of the guy I killed, the fact that the government takes me and throws me in a cage, as opposed to me giving them money? Now, it's true, they can sue me also. They can have a civil case. But the point is, nowadays, the thing, you know, you got to really worry about if you kill somebody is, oh, man, I might go to jail for 25 years. And that's the government saying, you know, you messed with us when you hurt somebody in our jurisdiction. Like, we take that personally. So on the one hand, it's kind of cute, like, oh, that's nice. They look out for their own citizens and they take it personally. But on the other hand, it's barbaric and not giving retribution or justice to the family. Okay, so I kind of hijacked that question. So what Malcolm was asking is, he said, the vergel in ancient Iceland for murder was the equivalent of about 12 and a half years of wages. Do we have any idea what life expectancy was at that time? This would allow us to see how they valued a life in terms of life expectancy. Again, I would go Google it. This is just how that would be the first thing I would do. And then if that didn't give me anything definitive, I would email David Friedman. Incidentally, Friedman probably will answer you. So he's got a website and a nice blog. If you do Google David, what's his middle? You should Google his middle initial because there's a lot of David Friedmans running around. But he will probably answer you, and I'm just being honest that's, if I were to answer your question, that's what I would do. My guess, if I had a guess, it's probably not more than 40 years old, I would think. So 12 and a half years actually is pretty, it's a good question you had. So Malcolm, if you do find that out, let me know. That's interesting. That, you know, if it works out that you owe somebody basically all of, not all, but half of your adult wages or something. Because that's what they do. I don't know if you guys know this, but in terms of the economic analysis of the value of a life, that's kind of what they do right now. Like if you're doing stuff like a cost-benefit analysis, as a dirty mainstream economist, not as a principled, pure Austrian one, and you want to do something like say, is it efficient in some sense to put in another escape hatch on an airplane, or for a car, like, you know, to put an airbag in on the passenger side, is that efficient in an economic sense? And again, not talking Austrian, talking mainstream stuff, and Walter Block would start vomiting if you heard me talk like this, but I just want to connect it to what you're asking me here, Malcolm. They'll do stuff. The answer will depend on how rich the society is and other factors too. So it's not just it's not a technological question. It involves market valuation. And the way that comes in is you say, well, so you can figure out, okay, what's the statistical chance of this saving a life or not, and you can say things like, well, over 100,000 passenger miles, if we put in this other airbag, the amount of fatalities will go down to such and such. And so maybe you end up saying, okay, we'll save over the next 20 years, we'll save whatever, 57 more lives. We'll avoid that many deaths from people who otherwise would have died in traffic fatalities, but at the cost of whatever, $64 million, because now we got to put in all these right passenger side airbags when otherwise we wouldn't have. And so the question then is $64 million worth spending in order to save however many lives I just said? I forget the number I said. So to answer that question, as an economist, you got to come up with a dollar value. You got to figure out, well, what is a human life worth? And so how do you do that? You don't say it's worth infinity, because then you couldn't do anything. Nobody could ever get behind a wheel, right? Nobody could ever skydive. Nobody could ever do anything, because if a life is infinitely valuable, no matter what you do, there's probabilistically you're possibly going to die. And so, it's infinitely costly, everything you do. So that doesn't work. So the way they come up with it is they say, well, if this guy works, what kind of wages can he bring in? But then he's also got to feed himself, and he's got to do, you know what I mean? So it's not just looking at your lifetime income gross, because you're not just a robot that goes out and produces income and doesn't consume it. And so that's the kind of approach they use to figure that out. So it leads to some odd results in the minds of some people, where if you're talking about like a tram that's delivering, that's moving brain surgeons around the grounds of a hospital complex, you using that approach, you might spend a lot more on safety mechanisms to keep them from getting in an accident and dying, whereas if you're talking about a tram that's shuttling around just like daycare workers who are watching little infants at a daycare center, you wouldn't spend as much money, because from that cost-benefit, you know, pure accounting dollars and cents approach, a human infant and some daycare worker who doesn't have a lot of other skills are not worth nearly as much is a trained brain surgeon who's right now 40 years old. Because right now he represents, boom, he's bringing in net income, tons of net income right now, and he's in the prime of his career. Whereas an infant, we don't know what he's going to do, and anyway, he's going to be a net drag on society for the next 16 years at least. And it's only, you know, in year 17 and beyond when he might start on net generating a surplus from society's point of view, and that discounts because it's not until 17 years from now. Right? So I'm just saying, I'm not saying this is the right way to do it, but that's how a normal economist would look at that stuff. So it's interesting to see if the fine for murder in ancient Iceland worked out to be like half of an adult wages expected, half of an adult's expected lifetime wages, because that's kind of ballpark what it would probably be, you know, even today, if we were to say what the value of money, because again, it's not your gross wages, because you got to take into account that you spend money to maintain yourself so you can go to work and everything. Okay. Malcolm says, in the ancient Icelandic system, seats of government were marketable commodities. Do you know of systems where a limited number of votes were issued and they sold to the highest bidders? I don't know of any system where that was done explicitly. Steve Landsberg, in his book, The Armchair Economist, talks about how it would be efficient if you could buy and sell votes. I may botch the argument here, so don't quote me. Don't file this away that this is what Steve Landsberg said, because it's been years since I've read this particular passage. But it was something like this. He was saying, look, at the U.S. government right now has all sorts of crazy, inefficient policies in place. Inefficient meaning in the sense that a mainstream economist would use it, that this policy imposes harms on losers that collectively are greater than the gain that grants to the winners, to the beneficiaries of the policy. So on net, in the aggregate, it's inefficient. It makes society poorer. So there's a puzzle there. Wait a minute, if that's true, how can these policies persist? Why wouldn't the losers pay the winners? Why couldn't they come up with a mutually advantageous compromise, right? So they have like tariffs. Beyond a natural rights sort of objection, saying what right does the government have to interfere with my ability to buy commodities from abroad, tariffs are stupid just on a standard cost-benefit basis, that they make society poor, that, yeah, they raise the wages of certain domestic workers, but they make the consumers poorer because prices are higher than they otherwise would need to be, or they restrict the quality of the products you can get or whatever. And so how do tariffs persist? Why don't the consumers all just make a side payment and say I mean, when they run the numbers, it's kind of thing like saying, I'm making this up, but this is the ballpark, that when they had, like in the 1980s, they had import quotas on Japanese cars. And some economists did rough ballpark estimates and concluded that for every extra job that was created in the Detroit auto sector because of these restrictions on Japanese auto imports, it cost something like $300,000 in terms of higher prices for consumers. So clearly, the auto workers weren't getting salaries of $300,000 to go to the factory and work on a Ford. That's not what they were getting paid. So the point was, if all the consumers somehow could have just struck a bargain with the Detroit auto workers and said, you can stay home and watch Jeopardy all day and we'll mail you checks for $100,000 a year to just sit on the couch and do nothing, we would all be better off. You don't ever have to work again, and you get paid what you're getting paid right now, or you pay a little bit more from your employer than what Ford is paying you or GM. And we get cheaper cars, and it's a win-win, you know, on average. But that doesn't happen. And so Landsberg was going through and showing that one of the reasons that doesn't happen is there's transactions costs, and one of the things is it's illegal to buy votes, because that's one of the ways you could do it is, you know, if you were trying to organize this coalition, what you really need to do is change the government policy. And so what you'd have to be saying to the Detroit auto workers is, we want you to stop voting for politicians who put tariffs in place. So we'll pay you to stop doing that. We want to elect a free trade guy. And so, you know, that. But you can't do that. First of all, because there's a secret ballot. You could pay someone who says, yeah, I'm going to go vote for Ron Paul. But then he goes behind the curtain and it comes up. Yep, I voted for Ron Paul. Give me my $20. But really, he voted for whoever, Barack Obama, and you wouldn't know. So anyway, Landsberg has a neat little discussion there. And it's what's clever about it is because that's the kind of thing where everyone's just horrified. Like, oh my gosh, buying and selling votes in democracy, that sounds like the epitome of evil. And yet Landsberg is showing, no, this would make the world so much better if people could do that. In other words, it's like another form of government intervention in the marketplace, that if you try to give money to somebody to influence how they go vote, the government will get mad at you. You're not allowed to do that. Or let alone can you go to Congress and literally buy votes, you know, tell politicians, here's $100,000, we want you to vote this way on this upcoming tariff bill. You can't do that. You go to jail. But the point is, not only would that be that if you could do that, the policies would probably end up being more efficient. Incidentally, I'm like I said, on the one hand, I may not have summarized his view correctly. I mean, he definitely talks about that stuff, but like I said, it's been 15 years probably since I read it, so I might be botching the particulars. The second thing is, with all this stuff, whenever you talk like this with governments and tweaking things, you need to be careful that you're holding other things equal. Because if you could do that, if it were legal to go to Washington and pay explicitly for guaranteed votes, the system might get worse, that the politicians then might enact or threaten to enact even scarier policies unless we paid them off. Whereas now, they still basically do it. It's not like right now votes aren't bought. It's that there's this real convoluted process where, people pay for the advertising and the super PACs, and they take them out on junkets, and they say stuff like, okay, once you get out of office, you're going to have this plush consulting career for the rest of your life, or we'll pay you $180,000 or something a year. So, I mean, it's not like votes aren't, in a sense, bought right now, but what I'm talking about is if it were literally bought the way you go buy hog futures or something, pork bellies. And there's a market price, and there's politicians who say, okay, I'm going to vote tomorrow on this, and I'm willing to go either way, but my fee is $187,000. Who wants it? Which side wants it more? That's what I'm talking about. If you had a system like that, I'm saying if the government's power were the same, then that one tweak would actually probably promote efficiency. But that's a very naive thing to say, because if they could get directly paid, then the sorts of things that they would threaten to do and the types of policies now that we would have to pay to have it go one way or the other would be different in that different equilibrium from what it is right now. And it's not obvious we would end up as citizens in this country being better off in the new approach. It's kind of like, let me just give you guys an example of what I mean, and then I'll turn back to your questions, is suppose, like people will sometimes say, when it comes to like selling your body parts, that, yeah, generally speaking, I think there should be a total legalization, there should be completely free market in selling body parts. So if some guy wants to sell a kidney, and there's some, somebody who needs a kidney, and that guy wants to pay $50,000 to the donor, why not? It seems like a win-win, and then there's more kidneys available, and if there's some guy who's kind of poor, but he's got two healthy kidneys, why not let him sell one, and now he's got more money, maybe he uses it to go to college, or maybe he uses it to help his family or whatever, but who are we to say that, no, you're not allowed to make that choice? What scares the heck out of me, though, is I've heard people say stuff like, well, to ease the organ shortage, because there is an organ shortage, in case you don't know that. There's plenty of people who are on waiting lists who need, a kidney transplant, and they just can't get it, and a lot of economists are saying, well, it's because the government's not allowing the market price to rise. If we allowed the market price to rise, you'd get more. So I've heard some people say, why don't we let convicted criminals get their sentences reduced if they're willing to donate a kidney? And that terrifies me. So what those people are thinking, they're thinking it's a win-win. Given that you're some guy who's got 20 years now, why not be able to donate the kidney and get 10 years knocked off? And to me, the answer is because if that's the new system, the judges would just give people bigger sentences, knowing that, oh, well, the guy's not really going to serve 20 years. He's going to give up a kidney and only serve 10 or whatever the numbers are. So that's an example where I would never in a million years say it's a good idea for the government to allow prisoners to reduce their sentence if they're willing to donate kidneys or other body parts or organs, whatever. So that's the kind of thing you got to be careful about. Okay, let's see. All right, so I think Malcolm still has the only one with pending questions in the Q&A box. So other people who have joined us, go ahead and type in your question. It's fine to do it right in the chat box because there's not that many of you, so I can see it there. But until that time, I'll keep taking on Malcolm's questions that are down here in the Q&A box. Okay, Malcolm says, in Rothbard's How to Desocialize, how would he and or you handle the dispersal of land that is not in the hands of peasants or factories? Example, forests, oil reserves under lakes, etc. Okay, so let me just summarize what I think Malcolm is getting at. So I think Rothbard said that, so the problem of how to desocialize, and remember, in that particular essay, he's actually not talking about the broader thing of how do you roll back a state to get to anarcho-capitalism. He's talking literally, what if you had a formerly socialist government that now is transitioning to a limited state free market? I mean, not totally free market, but what most people think of as a free market. How do you do that? So he is saying, you know, if you've got factories that originally were run by where the workers would come and work, but it was owned by the state, by the Communist Party or whatever the Soviet apparatus was called officially, Rothbard was saying, well, give it to the workers. Or, you know, these big communal farms, who gets them? And he was saying, well, give it to the peasants that have been working them for generations. And that kind of makes sense, because especially with the farms, chances are when the government came to power, when the particular Soviet regime took over, I mean, that was land that had been stolen probably from the ancestors of those very same people. I mean, it wouldn't be perfect, but it, you know, in a sense, that would be giving it back to the rightful owners. Whereas with the factories, it's a little bit harder because if the factory has been built from scratch during the Soviet rule, I mean, those resources were kind of taken from everybody, so it's not really, you can't really figure out who to give it to. So with all this stuff, the issue is you clearly don't want it to remain in the hands of the government. You want to get it in the hands of people in the private sector. And how do you do it? So a lot of economists say, oh, well, the way to do it, the fair way to do it is to just auction it off at the market price and then have the government either distribute that money equally among people or to do tax relief or to do whatever. But that's the way they would, in other words, they wouldn't want to just give it to some person because that's kind of unfair. So it might make more sense to you guys if you're thinking about the United States. In the United States, we talk about privatizing federal assets because the federal government right now owns tons of stuff. They own, in certain Western states, the vast majority of the real estate is owned by the U.S. federal government, for example. The federal government, and this is coming back to Malcolm's particular question, the federal government owns, in the United States, owns trillions of dollars worth of mineral resources. So like oil that's like directly offshore, like Gulf of Mexico, that kind of stuff. And then in Alaska, there's what's called ANWR, which many of you probably heard of. So, and a lot of this stuff is restricted. And so and also they own what's called the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, which has lots of barrels of oil that are in salt mines in various places that in case the U.S. government starts bombing Iran, they want to have a stockpile of oil so they can, so, you know, that we're not totally vulnerable to an interruption of oil imports. All right, so that's, and so I've written on this and others, like you could easily, I just did some back of the envelope calculations, you could easily raise $1 trillion. By selling very liquid assets. They also claim to own, we don't, you know, conspiracy theorists will say they actually don't own it, but on paper, the federal government owns a lot of gold as well. So clearly, if you're a free market economist, whether we're getting to anarcho-capitalism or just a limited night watchman state, there's no reason for the federal government to be owning all this oil and all this gold and all this forest land. That should just be all turned over to the private sector so that people in the private sector can decide how best to allocate it and develop those resources. So the question is, how do you get it from the federal government's control into the hands of people in the private sector? So the standard thing that most economists would say, and I've said this too in the context of with the debates over the debt ceiling, I was saying, no, we don't need to borrow more money. They can just start selling off assets, and that's how they can get revenue to get them over this hump. You don't need to borrow more money. So, I mean, I've done it too. I'm not criticizing, but the standard thing to say is sell them off at market rates to the highest bidder, and then you use that money to do whatever. So Rothbard actually, I don't know if he dwells on it in this essay, but elsewhere he has said, why should we do that? That's effectively the government then still having the resource. It's just they've transformed it from one form into another. The point is to get the resource back into the hands of the private sector. So the reason a normal economist would object is if you just said, okay, well, the workers who are working at the Strategic Petroleum Reserve and go to work every day, you know, dropping those barrels of oil and putting them in the salt caverns and stuff, we wouldn't just give all those barrels of oil to them, because that's a huge windfall. That would be like picking those 100 guys and giving them $10 billion. Why the heck would we do that? Why not instead sell that oil to oil companies, raise $10 billion or whatever the number is, and then just give across-the-board tax cuts to people, or just mail every U.S. citizen a check for the appropriate amount to give to everybody. So that's the kind of thing. But Rothbard is very suspicious of that because he thinks it would be corrupt. The point is you don't want to give the government control of these resources. They'll squander it, or they'll give it to their cronies. But it's naive to think, oh, if we could just get them into the private sector, if we just sell it at market prices, then the government can do something useful with the money. Because that's the mentality. With normal economists, when they're talking about privatization and stuff, they don't view the government as like this evil gang of criminals. They just view it as, you know, oh, this bumbling thing that doesn't use resources as efficiently as the private sector. And, of course, that's not Rothbard's view at all. He's viewing it as a bunch of criminals who are stealing and killing. So he, in his mind, the primary objective is get resources out of their hands immediately. You don't want them having anything to do with how these things are deployed. So, Malcolm, to answer your question, I think what Malcolm's getting at is how would you give the collective farms to the peasant workers, you give the factories to the workers maybe, but what do you do about the forests that the Soviet government technically owned? I don't know what Rothbard has written on that. And for me, it's the primary thing is to get it into the private sector. And I'm not as, I mean, just in terms of political realities and stuff, to just, let me put it this way. If you're going to say we can't trust the government to auction it off and then do something fair with the money, because they might just give the money to their cronies, by the same token, if the government just gives the forests to, like, they just says, okay, whoever gets there first gets it, I don't trust them to do that fairly either. I think they would notify their buddies and say, by the way, next Tuesday we're going to say whoever gets there first gets it, so you better get ready. You know what I mean? So given that it's the government that's going to be relinquishing control, no matter what we do, it's going to be corrupt. And so it would just be a matter of trying to design some process that's pretty transparent where if they sell it and get a bunch of money, well, keep track of how much money they got and then, you know, mail everybody a check or something. And then that's kind of hard for them to cheat with. So I guess that's what I would say. But with all this stuff, there's no right way to do it, because anytime you're talking about anything short of everyone in the government just quitting and saying, sorry, we see the error of our ways, and then everything's voluntary, you're always maintaining some amount of coercion, and there's no way to do that correctly, is what I'm saying. Okay. Malcolm says, has anyone written from an Austrian perspective on what actually occurred and how this led to the oligarchical situation we currently have in Russia? Pete Becky has written a ton of stuff on this. Having said that, there are some people in the Mises Institute community who don't like a lot of what Pete Becky writes. So I haven't read his stuff. I'm not saying whether it's good or bad. I don't know. But I do know he's written a ton of stuff on this. Richard Ebeling, I think, also has written a lot on the transition. My guess is Yuri Malta also has stuff on it, but I can't think of like a particular essay or something. But for sure, Pete Becky has written books on this topic, so he would be one person to go to at least. Okay. Let's see. Let me switch over to Colin Knight, because Malcolm, I've been answering a lot of your stuff. Okay. Colin Knight says, George Smith says, is there any area of government that's not corrupt? I don't know if you were just making a joke or not, but no. I mean, if you're a Rothbardian, by definition, the answer is no. And if you just mean in general, like empirically, do you look around and see any area that's not corrupt? No, I don't. Some areas seem worse than others. I mean, I think in the military, things are worse, not because necessarily of the nature of what they're doing, but simply because, I mean, I think that probably has something to do with it, but also, or like the CIA. Like, to me, if you're trying to say, like, what's the scariest organization where if you saw what they were doing behind closed doors, your jaw would drop and you would be like, my guess would be the CIA. All right. Whereas if I saw what they were doing at the Department of Education, I might be astounded at like how they were funneling money to their cronies or how they were overlooking systematic cheating on tests or something. But okay. Where the CIA, I mean, my guess is it's like in the movies where they really are just killing foreign leaders and stuff who don't do what the U.S. says and framing people and planning newspaper stories saying it was a heart attack and fomenting revolutions and stuff. I mean, I think they do that stuff. So that's what I mean, you know. So if you're saying, is there any part of the government that's not doing stuff that the average citizen would be shocked by if they saw it? My guess is no. Okay. Colin asks, do you know of any places that effectively implemented Rothbard's How to Desocialize or vice versa? You might look at, I think the experience was different in different places. Like in terms of the former Soviet republics, I think they had different experiences. But off the top of my head, I can't tell you, oh, this is the one to go look at. It's just not my area. I just did a report on Canada, or helped with the thing on Canada, that in the mid-1990s, they were facing a debt crisis. And they cut spending by almost 10% over 2 years. They went from being, the Wall Street Journal was writing op-eds saying they're going to be a third world country pretty soon in terms of their debt rating if they don't turn things around. And they balanced their budget, I think, 3 years after that article came out, and then ran 11 budget surpluses in a row. And their federal debt went from like 81% of GDP down to 45% of GDP in a decade. All right, so there are examples of countries that do things surprisingly close to the Austrian experience, whereas I wasn't aware of this. I only knew U.S. history really until fairly recently and just assumed governments never cut spending, that at best they would slow the rate of growth, and that's not true, that some governments faced with a serious debt crunch really did cut spending. And we see this too in Europe, some of these countries that are really in trouble, they are literally cutting spending, which is surprising. Australia, I know, had a massive move towards freer markets that a lot of even Austrian economists say that was a pretty good process. So with any of this stuff, and I mean, there was famous examples of the Chicago School economists advising Latin American governments in terms of getting inflation under control, and then, you know, but that stuff went hand in hand with guys being pretty autocratic and locking up dissidents and stuff. So, I mean, if any time you're dealing with this, I don't think you can ever point to, because even the Canadian example, they raised some taxes, which I wouldn't have done. So it's you're never going to point to some crystal clear thing, but there are more or less successes. Okay. Colin Knight says, I think Somalia is having an election soon. If they get a government like it's better with this, will this refute the ANCAP Somalia example? Well, it's hard to say because there's a couple things. In general, things get better over time. All right, so you wouldn't, like if life expectancy goes up over a 10-year period and there happens to be a state there, you wouldn't necessarily say, oh, see, it's because the state promotes life expectancy. I mean, strictly speaking, with all this stuff, you want to have a counterfactual and say, well, what would it have done under anarcho-capitalism? Or without a state, because Somalia doesn't really have anarcho-capitalism. The reason, Colin, I don't know, Colin's asking me about the Canada example. David R. Henderson had a Mercatus study on it, if you want that, or this thing I'm working on, it's if you read my blog, I mean, once it comes out, I'll promote it. Like, I'm going to probably have op-eds and stuff, and it's a book that this Canadian think tank is putting out. So, I mean, when that's officially released, I'll mention that on my blog, which is called Free Advice. Okay. So as far as the Somalia example, like I said, there's that. So it's, in case people think, wait a minute, but you're trying to have it both ways. When life expectancy went down with the state, wait, how'd that go? Life expectancy was falling under the state, and then you cited that, and you tried to, so now why wouldn't you do it the other way? Because, that's what I'm saying, under the Somali regime the last few years before it fell, life expectancy was dropping. So that's unusual. You know, generally people learn and they get better over time. And so you would think just normal baseline life expectancy improves. And so the fact that it was falling shows something was screwy. And so the fact that it was falling, then the state fell and they had anarchy and the life expectancy started rising again, that's pretty significant. Whereas if now they reestablish a state and life expectancy continues to rise, that doesn't prove the state promotes life expectancy. That's, you know, I suppose you could do things like look at trends, and then if they start increasing at a faster rate that seems to occur right when the state comes in, that would be prima facie evidence. Let's see. Malcolm asks, there was a review on Amazon on your chaos theory where a reviewer says that Mises said that anarchism is a mental disorder. Do you know if he said that? I don't remember him saying a mental disorder per se, but clearly in Human Action, Mises thought that the anarchists were deluded. I don't remember him calling it mental disorder. That just seems like an odd thing for Mises to call it. But he was saying, but again, in Human Action, none of this is relevant to Rothbardian anarcho-capitalism. Because if you go and look in the passage, so go get the Human Action PDF and just search for the term anarchism or anarchists, and you'll see. What Mises is attacking there is the lack of law enforcement. So Mises is taking the anarchist position to be, we don't need police of any kind. We don't need to have enforcement of laws if it's only us trying to make people good that causes criminality. If we all just stop judging people and stop trying to force them to do what we want with guns, then peace and harmony would flourish. And Mises is saying, no, if society weren't willing to crush those who would use violence to disrupt the social order, then society is impossible. So all Mises is really doing there is actually attacking pacifism. He's not really attacking anarchism the way we're using it in this course. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying Mises was an anarcho-capitalist. He wasn't. But I'm saying in his mind, he thought the state was necessary to provide law and order and military defense. And since he thought you need laws and you need police and you need jails and you need militaries, therefore you need a state. So I'm not an anarchist, and anarchism is wrong. That was like the implicit syllogism he had. So, but he never spelled out why he thought you needed a state to have laws and jails and militaries. And that's kind of what the whole debate is over here. All right, let me answer one more. Malcolm says, I'm a little confused on the point of the last sentence of this footnote in chaos theory. In this context, libertarian implies a respect for natural rights. The libertarian's ultimate credo is the non-aggression axiom, namely that it is illegitimate to initiate force. Although market anarchy is, so Malcolm here is quoting me, Caster. Although market anarchy, as I will describe it, does not rest upon libertarianism, I will argue that it is largely consistent with this philosophy. Divergences between the two are, I believe, points of weakness in the libertarian position. And now I think Malcolm's asking me, why did I say that? Okay, so, yeah, this is, so to be clear, I was taking libertarian to be libertarian philosophy as Murray Rothbard expounded it in things like the Ethics of Liberty. So someone who says, I believe people have rights, whether they come from nature and reason or whether they come from God, doesn't matter. I believe people have rights, and I believe in the non-aggression axiom, which says it is immoral to initiate force against somebody. Okay, so that's what a libertarian is. And I was saying in chaos theory, I was describing market anarchy, which is not the same thing. So it's kind of like saying, as an economist, I can talk about a laissez-faire market for cocaine. In there, I'm not using any kind of value system or moral judgments. I'm just saying as an economist, this is how the producers of cocaine would operate. This is what the consumers would do. And I'm not taking a stand on whether it's moral to use cocaine. I'm not taking a stand on whether it's moral to ban it. I'm just saying this is what would happen. And so that's what I was getting at there, that, yes, a lot of libertarians are going to be attracted to what I'm writing here, but strictly speaking, I'm not describing a libertarian world. I'm describing market anarchy. And then the last part about divergences, I had in mind things like gun control, where a lot of libertarians, so it's not that I'm saying libertarianism is wrong. What I was saying, though, is I was trying to get at is I think a lot of libertarians, who that's the way they come at an issue and not as a market anarchist, thinking about law as being settled in a voluntary market setting, but instead thinking, no, these are these principles, and a just society has to conform to these principles, otherwise it's not free. I think they would sometimes come up with the wrong answer on something. So, for example, with gun control, I think a lot of libertarians say, no, as long as I don't initiate force, I can do whatever I want, and nobody has the right to tell me I can't have guns. And I think, you know, if you take that to the logical limit, that means, well, no, if I want to have a hydrogen bomb in my basement, then I can, and the landlord has no business telling me I can't do that. And that's not right. Obviously, with property rights in general, the landlord can say you can't have pets, you can't smoke, oh, and you can't have a nuclear bomb in your basement, right? Or you can't have an AK-47. And so, like I said, in that setting, it's not that I just proved libertarianism was wrong. That's all. You could be a libertarian and agree, oh, yeah, the landlord owns the property. He can tell me whatever what the rules are. And if he says I'm not allowed to have an AK-47, then I'm not. But I'm just saying a lot of people, when they talk about gun control or when they talk about things like, well, gee, if I get accused of murder, how many appeals do I get and stuff, they often, even Rothbardians, try to answer that from first principles, like relying on axioms, whereas if I said to them, what should the price of gasoline be, it wouldn't occur to them to bring up the non-aggression principle. they would say, well, that's, you know, that's a market, that's for the market to decide. How would I know that? But when we ask stuff like, would there be gun control, they have the crisp answer, like, well, no, because that's in a, you know, that's what I mean. Like, so partly you could say, well, it depends what we mean by gun control. If you mean a government doing, well, then of course not. But if you mean, are there some people who would like to carry weapons in certain areas, but then it's against the rules, well, then, yeah, I think of course there would be that, or there could be that, and that's totally consistent with a free society. Okay, so that's what I meant by that. So it's not that I ever thought that I was saying libertarianism was wrong, but that a lot of times people who deploy that philosophy to answer some question about what would a free legal system yield, I think would come up with the wrong answer or an answer that could be wrong. Okay, well, we're over time, so why don't I stop there? Thanks, everyone, for tuning in. I will skim through these, and if I have any decent things to say further, I'll try to post them. But for some of your questions, I don't, you know, if you're asking me some historical question, I would just be Googling it myself. All right, guys, thanks for taking the class, and hope you learned a lot. We'll see you later.